Well, I think we'll get started. I'm sure there, given the way traffic was this morning, I don't know what it was like on the metro, but Washington seems to have been inundated with New York-style traffic for the morning, so I'm sure we'll have some latecomers trickling in. I want to welcome all of you here at the Institute this morning. My name is Carola Weil. I'm a program officer in the grants program here at USIP. And have recently joined, actually it's not so recently anymore, I should stop saying that, I joined the Institute this year, but previously was working on questions of humanitarian intervention, displaced people through conflicts and forced migration. And so I was very pleased to be asked to help organize a meeting from which all of us have just returned, which we had put together in lovely Virginia countryside, and we have just spent a day and a half of very intense discussions on a topic that continues to vex the United Nations, its member states, humanitarian actors of all stripes, both civilian and military, and has profound implications for civilians caught up in armed conflict. And that is, how do we effectively protect civilians and translate what has become known as the responsibility to protect into real action on the ground? I'll give you just a quick overview of why we put together this conference, what our thinking was, who participated in it, and then I have asked, and then we'll introduce my co-speakers, and we have asked them to give you a flavor of the discussion as well as some of their additional thoughts that they might have had since departing our conference venue yesterday. And then we'll open it up to discussion, because I know there are many around you, around the table here, that have equal, if not more, knowledge than those of us in the front. So we're looking forward to a terrific discussion over the next 2 hours. I would also like to note that we're very pleased that all of you have made it, because we actually ended up battling technology last week. The Institute had an unfortunate crash of its email server, and so many of you received the invitations only very late, and so we are particularly pleased that you were able to take time out of your schedules at such short notice. And I think that had we had a little bit more lead time, we might have even had a larger audience given the centrality of the topic, but again, thank you so much for taking the time today. Why should we put this conference together at this point? There's several reasons, both an institutional reason as well as the general political environment in which we are currently situated. Both the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty in 2001 and the UN Secretary General's High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change in 2004 noted that one of the most difficult problems facing the UN and its member states is how to best respond to large-scale humanitarian crises, particularly in settings of armed conflict. That problem remains with us today. We only need to look at the front page of the Post of the New York Times. We have problems in Congo and Darfur. We're debating whether or not to send troops, how we do it, what do we do, how many lives can we save, if any. State failure, ethnic strife, interstate conflict, and the forced displacement of citizens both within and across borders frequently converge. This makes the protection of civilians an urgent but also very complex matter. Humanitarian protection clearly does not take place in a vacuum. Although ideally motivated by the most altruistic of intentions, the protection of civilians in armed conflict is neither apolitical nor value-free. Thus, the conference on focused on relations between the United Nations and its member states, the interagency processes at international and national levels, and the current context of civil-military relations that affect the way in which we translate principles that have been accepted at the UN, most recently through Security Council Resolution 1674, as well as at the 2005 World Summit, that sovereign states do in fact have an obligation and a responsibility to protect civilians. And not if ideally, that responsibility lies with the government that oversees the citizens of its own country. However, if that government is unable or unwilling to do so, then the international community is required, obligated, by these agreements to step up to the plate and take over the responsibility. Now, that all looks wonderful on paper. The question is, how do you actually do it? Who does it? Who decides? Under which authority do you do it? And what does it do to other international laws that we have that regulate the international system? How does this mesh with the UN Charter, which says that you will not intervene in another state's international affairs? So we spent the last day and a half talking about some of these principled questions, but then we also got down to the nitty-gritty. We had panels on the threats to humanitarian action in fragile peace environments, where we talked about the shrinking humanitarian space that occurs when you have civilian and military actors working very closely together, and the risk that you might politicize what otherwise would be considered neutral humanitarian assistance or impartial humanitarian assistance. We talked about some of the operational and legal disconnects between the actual reports, responsibility to protect, or the principles that it put forward 5 years after it has passed, and what some of the difficulties were in actually operationalizing these principles. We talked about different approaches to creating security for civilians, the different kinds of strategies that civilian humanitarian NGOs use, the strategies put in place by armed forces, and one example being the PRTs in Afghanistan. We also talked about how do we actually define and measure success in human security, and that's clearly is a very challenging question, but it has vital questions, not just for methodology, for those of us who like to think about the more esoteric aspects of social science, but also how do we design programs that can improve and that where we can learn from lessons of the past. And so we want to give you a bit of a flavor of those meetings. Unfortunately, we could not have all of our participants join us this morning, but we do have a very select group. But I do want to just let you know who some of our other participants were. Most notably, they included Carolyn McCaskey, who is the new Assistant Secretary General for Peacebuilding. As many of you know, last year, a new commission, the Peacebuilding Commission, was put into place, which is supposed to think about peace support operations and what happens after conflict. How do we address questions of reconstruction, of nation building, of state building, once we have actually gotten over the emergency? So she provided us with very insightful remarks on the challenges that she poses, and I have to say I don't envy her at all. We also had distinguished members of the U.S. Armed Services with us, many of whom have been very instrumental in putting together the Department of State and actually the U.S. government's policy on stability operations. We had members of the UN, including Anthony Gregg, who now is with UNHCR. Actually, he's with UNHCR, seconded from the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. We had members of various foreign ministries from Canada, from Egypt. We had representatives from various NGOs there as well, including some of the people I will introduce here on this panel. So without further ado, let me introduce our speakers and ask each one of them to give you a flavor of their sessions as well as their own thoughts on the topic, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Let me first of all introduce a person without whom this conference would not have happened, because this was actually a partnership project between us and the Center for International Cooperation at New York University. And I would like to introduce Bruce Jones, who is the co-director of CIC and who leads the research on the evolution of multilateral security institutions and the UN. Many of you might know Dr. Jones not only as a well-known author of books such as Peacemaking in Rwanda, The Dynamics of Failure, the UN and Post-Crisis Aid, but also because he served as Deputy Research Director for the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change, as well as Special Advisor to the Secretary General and the Assistant Secretary General for Strategic Planning in negotiating security issues during reform efforts at the UN. I believe there are bios out, so I won't go into greater detail, but they might also be able to add some of their own notes if I have left off anything. We then will hear from Paul O'Brien, who is to my far left. Paul O'Brien currently is with the Office of the President of Afghanistan. He recently, 2 years ago, had left an NGO, CARE USA, where he served as advocacy coordinator in Afghanistan from September 2001 until mid-2004. During that time, CARE advocated systematically on security issues for the Afghan citizenry and humanitarian and development workers. In 2004, he left CARE to become the senior advisor to Ashraf Ghani, then the Minister of Finance, and his successor and the current Minister of Finance, Anwar Ahadi. Over the last year, he has worked in the office of the President of Afghanistan, facilitating the development of the country's national development strategy. He, however, actually lives in Nairobi, Kenya, which just goes to show how transnational these activities truly are. So we're particularly pleased that he could join us here in Washington. We then turn to Randolph Martin, who is Director of Global Emergency Operations at the Mercy Corps. Randy Martin has been engaged in international work for over 25 years, serving in senior management positions in the field and at headquarters. He has lived and worked in Egypt, Sudan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the Pacific, and has traveled widely. He has lectured and published on topical humanitarian issues ranging from peace in Sudan and the politics of refugees in Pakistan to the challenges of providing security for humanitarian aid workers. Last but not least, and I just realized I don't have your bio. My apologies.
She knows me too well.
Know him too well. But last but not least, my colleague to my right, Taylor Siebold. Dr. Siebold has been with USIP for 4 years.
4 years.
In the grant program. But he also has been working very closely on issues of humanitarian and policy and security policy. Before joining USIP, he was at SIPRI, the Swedish Institute for
Stockholm International Peace Research Institute.
I should know this by now. My apologies. And he has a book forthcoming with Oxford University Press on this very topic, and will be speaking to us about how measuring success of humanitarian interventions. And so without further ado, let me turn the table over to Bruce. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about the development of the norms and the legal basis for protection of civilians and the responsibility to protect. But then I'll also talk about a series of gaps, I think important gaps, that we face in trying to operationalize that concept. Of course, the protection of civilians is a concept that's been around for a long time, and for one of the communities that participated in the workshop over the last few days, the humanitarian community, it's the founding basis of the entire enterprise. If you look back to the founding documents and the founding legal debates that started the International Committee of the Red Cross or the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, it is the legal and physical protection of civilians in war that is the founding purpose of the humanitarian community. There are those who would argue in the humanitarian community that the protection mandate, the protection basis of humanitarian operations has been somewhat lost, with a trend towards a focus on provision of food assistance, medical assistance, other forms of assistance, and less of an emphasis on protection. And others, myself among them, who would argue that all of those activities, the provision of assistance of any type, is in fact a form of protection, both because the assistance itself is required for civilians to survive in conditions of war, and also because the act of providing it creates at least the potential for what humanitarians refer to as protection through presence, i.e. the fact of international humanitarian workers being deployed alongside civilians, refugees, IDPs, at least ostensibly provides some degree of protection to them. Nevertheless, it's quite clear that by the mid-1990s and certainly through the late 1990s, the humanitarian community as a whole, irrespective of which position you take on that debate, the humanitarian community as a whole was making the case rather compellingly that the protection of civilians was not a business that could be left to humanitarians alone, that there were important military and political dimensions to it that had to be taken up by political and military actors, and in particular, the UN Security Council. And that led to a debate at the UN Security Council, interestingly led by the humanitarians in the UN, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, where I worked at the time, around the protection of civilians, a report by the Secretary General to the Security Council, and ultimately the first of what have been then a series of resolutions by the Security Council adopting the concept and the principle of the protection of civilians as an important part of the job of the maintenance of international peace and security. By 1999, the first UN Security Council resolution on protection of civilians had been adopted. And indeed, since that time, and I'll come back to this point, most, not all, but most UN peacekeeping operations that have been endorsed by the Security Council since then have had protection of civilians mandates as one component of broader mandates for peacekeeping. Around 2000, though, the debate in 1999-2000, the debate took a kind of a different turn. And if you remember around the Kosovo question, the issue was not so much how do we protect civilians on the ground once we were in an operation, the kind of practical question of protection of civilians. The question in and around Kosovo was, what is the basis of the intervention itself, and should we intervene to protect civilians? So the debate was sort of elevated from being a debate around how do we protect to why do we intervene. And the whole question of humanitarian intervention then became a central debate at the UN in the first part of this decade, and a very controversial one. And indeed, Kofi Annan's 2000 speech on humanitarian intervention was extremely badly received by most of the membership, and he got a lot of pushback, in particular from Asian and African countries, though not exclusively, saying this is just Western interventionism, this is just a cover for military adventurism. What we then saw was a kind of clever tactical retreat with the Canadian-led International Commission on State Sovereignty, which took the concept out of the UN and did a kind of second-track effort in various communities around the world, turning the question on its head and asking people in Africa and Egypt and other places, all right, if you don't want intervention, what do you want to see happen if we face another Rwanda? And what emerged from that was this question of the responsibility to protect, which, as you then know, was adopted or endorsed by the UN's high-level panel and then thrown into the negotiating mix during the very complex, and I have to say very bizarre, negotiations that led up to the UN's World Summit in September 2005. Perhaps one of the most surprising aspects of which is that we actually ended up succeeding getting General Assembly endorsement for the concept of responsibility to protect, and fairly strong language, or at least decent language, in the outcome document endorsing the idea of a responsibility to protect when governments have failed to protect their civilians from large-scale atrocities, arguing that the Security Council did indeed have a responsibility to act in those circumstances. A very important normative and legal development at the UN. And then most recently, as Kirill said, endorsed by the Security Council in Resolution 1674. It's actually an enormous distance to travel in normative and legal terms since the very fraught debates around humanitarian intervention in 2000. And I think it's worth just pausing for a moment to ask, why was it that in 2005 we could get the General Assembly to sign off on responsibility to protect when it had been so fraught in 2000? And I think there are three explanations, maybe four. I would give credit to Canada and the leadership that they showed in these negotiations, including during the summit negotiations when Prime Minister Paul Martin personally made phone calls to President Musharraf and others to get them to shift their position on RTT. I would give credit to our team doing the diplomacy, particularly a young guy called Sebastian Einsiedel, who did a lot of the negotiations behind the scenes, and kind of clever diplomacy makes a difference in these cases. Bizarrely, I think that the fact of the U.S. occupation of Iraq at that time and the U.S. doctrine of preemption, or the kind of international perceptions of the doctrine of preemption, helped us get RTP through in a strange way, because we could argue that giving the Security Council the responsibility to act for humanitarian intervention was a lot better than leaving it up to the Americans. Certainly in UN terms, that was a selling argument. But most of all, I think what turned the tide in 2005 was that a few key African countries came out strongly in favor of the responsibility to protect. In particular, Rwanda and South Africa took a firm stand in the General Assembly saying this is not a Western concept, this is not an interventionist concept, this is about protection, we need this concept, we need this to be operationalized, this is for us. Which made it very difficult for the non-aligned movement and others to portray the R2P as a kind of Western interventionist concept, and that helped enormously. Well, that's norms. But there's a big difference between norms and realities. And you only have to look at Darfur to see that there is an enormous difference at present between the development of the norm on the one hand and our ability to operationalize it on the other. And indeed, I think we're facing three major gaps in our ability to operationalize the responsibility to protect: a political gap, a capacity gap, and an implementation gap. Let's start at the political gap. For everything I've just said about the adoption of the R2P concept in the General Assembly in September 2005, it would be absolutely false to say that, therefore, the concept enjoys widespread support. It does not. Those negotiations involved a small number of powerful states, India, Pakistan, the United States, etc. There were real negotiations at the level of prime ministers and foreign ministers. It wasn't sort of third secretaries in the basement of the UN negotiating this stuff. This was at the highest possible level. But a fairly small number of countries involved. And in the way the UN works, the fact is if you get a few powerful countries to agree on language, then that language sails through. It does not necessarily mean that 191 countries believe that there is such a thing as a responsibility to protect. They do not. There is still deep suspicion about this concept in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and in other places. And I think we have to acknowledge that we've seen significant reversals since then. In the Arab world, the recent Israel-Hezbollah war is seen very negatively in terms of these issues. The perception is this, and we hear this very much at the workshop: you adopt responsibility to protect language, and then a war breaks out in which Lebanese civilians are being killed. There's no reference really to Israeli civilians when you hear it from this perspective, but nevertheless. Civilians are being killed, and the Security Council doesn't even meet for several weeks to discuss the Israel-Hezbollah war. So do you actually mean it about responsibility to protect, or is it just a Western interventionist concept? So those suspicions are very much still alive and I think have been fueled by the Israel-Hezbollah war. And in Africa, you see something different, again around the Lebanon story though, where even those Africans who were fighting for the concept in 2005 and are supporting the idea of a UN mission in Darfur against the Sudanese government, look at Lebanon and contrast the two facts. When we've been arguing for troops for Burundi or for Sierra Leone or for Somalia or for wherever, the response from Europe is typically, gosh, really sorry, don't have any, can't send them, don't really have the capacity to deploy, etc. And then Lebanon comes up, and within days, Europe can mobilize 5,000 serious troops to go into Lebanon. And Africans look at that and say, well, okay, that just proves our suspicion that you will undertake the responsibility to protect only when it's in your immediate direct interest and it's got nothing to do with actual protection of civilians. And so it's a ruse. Right? So there are different types of suspicions in those two groups of countries, but the suspicions are deep in their role. And then this is connected last to another political question, although partly this is tactics, partly this is real, and Carola already alluded to it, which is the who decides question, and what both African and Asian and Latin American countries will push on considerably is the question of Security Council reform, which of course failed in the UN reform effort. And the argument there is to say, so long as it's an outdated anarchic Security Council representing a 1945 world order, we don't trust the Security Council to be the body that authorizes or doesn't authorize responsibility to protect missions. The answer to that, of course, is if you expand the Security Council, you're going to get fewer authorizations, not less. But that's an argument that requires debates and deliberation. That's at the kind of high political level. Then there's a capacity gap, which is a slightly more concrete thing, but still a real problem. And here we have to take a step back and look at trends in global peace operations. What we have seen over the past 6 years at the UN is a fivefold increase in the number of peacekeeping troops deployed. My center did a report on this, the first of an annual series, and there's copies of the summary outside. We've seen a growth in UN peacekeeping from around 20,000 five or 6 years ago to almost 100,000 now, with projections that will grow to 120,000 by the middle of this year. This is enormously rapid growth for the UN, and the UN is facing serious overstretch in its ability to plan, manage, mobilize, and maintain those missions. Plus, you have 20,000-30,000 NATO troops in the field, plus 10,000-odd EU troops in the field, plus 10,000-odd AU troops in the field, and the net global capacity to provide troops to these operations is stretched incredibly thin. We've just authorized a large expansion in Lebanon, and we've just authorized a new mission in Darfur, and nobody knows where those troops are coming from. I suspect we will end up getting the troops for Lebanon because it's the Middle East, and everything in the Middle East is different than everywhere else. I will be very surprised, to be perfectly frank, if we manage to clear away the politics of the Darfur operation. The UN is still going to have an extremely difficult time mounting up that operation and getting the relevant troops and the right kinds of troops for that operation. Darfur, I'm afraid to say, looms large as a kind of colossal disaster in the making for the UN, quite apart from the colossal disaster for humanity it already is. And that's to say nothing of an even tougher challenge of mobilizing civilian police, foreign police units, and civilian staff. The UN currently has 2,500 vacancies for civilian staff in its peacekeeping operations, not because the UN doesn't have the right systems for recruitment and stuff, although those are pretty bad, but because, you know, how many countries do you know that have standby reserves of central bank governors and standby reserves of public administrators? They just don't exist, these things. And the ability to mobilize civilians to governance functions, rule of law functions, etc., is extremely difficult. So the overstretch problem, the capacity problem, is a real one in terms of our ability to implement protection of civilians operations generally. And the third gap that we face is an implementation gap. Even when the UN has, or NATO or anybody else, has a peacekeeping protection of civilians mandate, even when we have the troops, the civilians, the police, etc., there are several problems that arise in implementing a protection of civilians mandate. First among them, I would say, is a perception problem. When you describe a mission as a protection of civilians mission, surprisingly enough, civilians expect to be protected. And then when you deploy 17,000 of them across the DR Congo, which is a territory larger than Western Europe, their ability to actually do that on a day-to-day basis is pretty stretched, and you can create very serious expectations and public perception problems pretty rapidly. Second, you have a problem of knowledge. Do force commanders, do special representatives, do sort of military commanders understand and know how to do this? Some have some experience and some knowledge of how to do it. Many do not, and we saw that in the seminar this last week. And third, do the troop contributors, do the forces involved, have the doctrine and the training necessary to undertake what some countries would call counterinsurgency, others would call protection of civilians, spoiler management? There are lots of different ways you can approach this problem. Are the troops that we have trained and equipped, and do they have the doctrine to do this? And the answer is, by and large, not really. The Simpson Center's Future of Peace Operations is tackling this question, among others. But there is this political gap, these capacity gaps, and these implementation gaps are real. And I think that the gulf between where we have rapidly got to on the normative side and where we are on the operational side is there's a pretty deep gulf there and a pretty difficult gulf. I'll wrap up by saying the kind of three steps we need to do to take these, to fix this problem in reverse order of difficulty, are to enhance doctrine development and training for the troops involved in implementing these operations. I think we have to continue to undertake normative diplomacy at the UN and in bilateral relationships to convince countries, especially in Africa and in the Middle East, that this is not just an interventionist concept, this is not just an American and Western concept. And I suspect that what that means is taking seriously the second half of the Canadian report, which is the responsibility to prevent, which everybody has forgotten about, and which talks about development, which talks about human rights, which talks about a whole set of things that you can do to prevent us getting to the point where you're involved in protection of civilians operations. And last and most difficult, I think it requires serious efforts to deepen net global peacekeeping capacity by bringing other nations into this business. There are a lot of emerging market nations, sort of emerging nations, middle-income nations that do not participate in peacekeeping but could. By reconfiguring existing forces in developed countries. Australia has taken important steps in this regard. Most countries yet have not. And by building up our police, constabulary, and civilian capacities. But all of those are hard things to do. But I'll end on that note.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Paul.
Okay. Hi. I participated in the second panel discussion, which looked at the preservation of humanitarian space in complex environments. I was the fourth of four speakers. I'd very briefly like to reflect on a couple of the comments of my fellow speakers. The foundation was laid for us by two speakers, Elizabeth Rowley of Johns Hopkins University and Abby Stoddard of the Center for International Cooperation, who provided the empirical
decent language in the outcome document.
What they put on the table was how the reality had changed for the foot soldiers of humanitarian work and peace building work, the NGO community in large part, although they spoke to how security affected other actors as well. A couple of their findings. There was a comment during the discussion, I remember, where some of the older hands, I think somebody was reminiscing with Randy about how 20, 30 years ago, the key threats to humanitarian workers were illnesses and accidents, and how that had changed over time, and they showed it how numerically it had changed over time. So now the majority of deaths in humanitarian contexts are as the result of intentional killings. Abby spoke about how in both absolute and relative terms the numbers of killings are going up, and how the NGO community in particular is experiencing a disproportionate number of casualties. One other interesting thing I saw from one of Abby's slides was how increasingly casualties are happening in Islamic countries. I think the top five countries on her chart, I remember Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Chechnya,
Sudan.
They were where casualties were highest. So it laid a pretty sobering foundation for our discussions. The next speaker was the president of Islamic Relief, and it was he offered some very interesting juxtaposed observations to sort of set the tone for the discussion. I think his first point is, look, you know, he made the point about how this was disproportionately happening in Islamic countries, and how if that was a reality, you couldn't have a purely secular discussion about this challenge and how it needed to be solved. He put the religious issue front and foremost on the table and said we've got to start integrating religion and its aspects into our discussions, even of how to preserve humanitarian space. He referred to the fact that religion need not necessarily be a divisive element in the discussion, and referred to the deep faith of the American people. He compared that with what he viewed as perhaps the lesser adherence to faith in the European context. And I think the point he was really focusing on, he made most clearly when he talked about the importance of addressing the disproportionate influence of the American giant, who, when they sneeze, changes the rules of the game. And he said, I certainly took from that perhaps the disproportionate responsibility of U.S. policymakers to think about the question of humanitarian space and how their decisions impacted on humanitarian space. And it was a convenient thing to take from the discussion because we had such a great array of folks from the U.S. policymaking environment there. Then came my turn for discussion. I do work in the political environment in Afghanistan now, but I think the reason I was there and what I found most useful to talk about was my experience in the NGO community, and I want to share a couple of observations with you from that time. I think the NGO community, as not the policymakers but the foot soldiers, have had their own their own strategies for preserving humanitarian space, and what I wanted to put on the table was a dilemma. Classic humanitarians have preserved humanitarian space I pointed to two things in particular. Firstly, avoiding taking political sides in conflict settings, and in particular, not taking funding from belligerents. That's something that ICRC, or perhaps more accurately, MSF, which is an NGO that seeks funding from governments, would never do. So MSF would never take money from the U.S. government in Afghanistan, for example. So that was one dimension of what classic humanitarians do. The second thing they do is they make explicit the fact that they are not going to pass judgment on the justness of a war, so that they can preserve their ability to address issues of human rights and humanitarian law in a war, meaning the conduct of humanitarian law and violations thereof. I worked for an organization which fairly explicitly and intentionally decided that the best way to preserve humanitarian space in Afghanistan was to deviate from those two principles. And we took a different task. And so what I thought would be interesting to put on the table was how we did that and whether it actually stood up on reflection to have positively impacted our ability to work effectively in Afghanistan. 2001, overwhelming consensus on the state-building project for Afghanistan in the wake of the fall of the Taliban. Everybody wanted to see a tolerant democracy, free market economy, governed by the rule of law, develop. There was a lot of attention given to building a multilateral coalition of actors towards the achievement of those goals. And CARE stepped back, looked at that, and as an organization that had embraced human rights in the previous few years, we said these goals are fundamentally consistent with what we're trying to achieve globally and in particular in Afghanistan. And so we take sides in this discussion. That is the agenda we think the international community and the Afghan people should be working towards. And we are not going to be neutral about the outcome. What did that mean specifically? It meant that we turned around to U.S. policymakers, and as I think you all know, U.S. government gives CARE, I still think, the majority of its funding. It hovers around 50%, and said to the U.S. government, it's great that you said there would be a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. Now it's time to actually implement that Marshall Plan. It's great that you said your challenge was to nurture a responsible Afghan government. That means you need to start spending far more funding through the Afghan government, holding them accountable and stamping out corruption, and you need to do it early. And you need to stop spending money on symptomatic programs that are focused on winning over hearts and minds in the short term and investing in more long-term investments like infrastructure, roads and energy, which would take years to bear fruit but would lay the foundation of sustainable economic growth. On the security front, where other organizations would never, if they adopted the classic model of humanitarianism, they would never have spoken out on what international forces should be doing, except to the extent that they violated international humanitarian law. Together with organizations like the Stimson Center, we embraced the question of what kind of security configuration would actually deliver real human rights protection to the ordinary Afghan people, and concluded in early 2003 that there just weren't enough troops on the ground to be serious about this effort. So we argued for the expansion of ISAF very publicly in the U.S. media, with U.S. policymakers here in Washington and in Europe through NATO and other modalities. We argued for the expansion of peacekeeping forces. We challenged the military to tackle the drugs trade far more directly. We questioned whether the initiation of the conflict in Iraq would undermine attention on Afghanistan long before the securitization of Afghanistan had been achieved. We talked, and this would have been consistent with our classic humanitarian allies, about the need to conduct the conflict in the south in such a way that did not alienate the southern populations. In 2004, MSF and other more classic humanitarian organizations challenged CARE. They said that we were doing damage to the humanitarian community by engaging so explicitly in trying to make the what they called Karzai-led state-building agenda work. We were choosing sides in other ways, in other words, that would compromise the long-term ability of the entire humanitarian community to function effectively in Afghanistan. Coming from an organization like MSF, which we all respected, this was before the tragic loss of MSF lives in Afghanistan, we all took this critique very seriously. And today, 2006, some of their critique looks fairly prophetic. Nobody thought in 2004 that we would be talking about Afghanistan with such concern when it came to the state-building agenda. Karzai, recently elected as president in late 2004. Today his popularity has significantly dwindled. Drugs, as I think you know from the latest reports, is continuing to go up exponentially. The U.S. military NATO and the U.S. military are talking about creating, not expanding, but creating safe development zones in southern Afghanistan, bringing together a package of security, governance, and economic development tools. So, you know, the worst fears of the classic humanitarian community at some level are not entirely unrealistic. It is possible to imagine today that the Taliban might at some point in the future be asked to enter into some kind of political arrangement where they have some share of power. It's not impossible. It's perhaps not what the military leaders are saying, but in the humanitarian community living in Afghanistan, people do talk about this. So there's a real question. Did organizations like CARE that got political, that supported the state-building agenda, make a very big mistake? And should we be returning to classic humanitarian values if we are going to continue to preserve humanitarian space? My own views, for what they are worth, and I don't think I represent entirely now where CARE is. I don't mean to. Please don't take these comments publicly as a statement of CARE policy. But I think certainly the folks in CARE that I worked with at the time and who are still in CARE would say we were right to do what we did, and if we have any regrets about what we did, it's that we didn't do it more. And I'd like to sort of explain how and why I believe that to be the case, looking at four of the key constituencies that perceive our activities and interpret them. One is the anti-government forces in Afghanistan. Two, the international military and their perspectives. The government of Afghanistan, for whom I went to work, and the Afghan people, most importantly. And I'm sorry to leave them to last, but I think they are the most important, and I think it ultimately justifies why we did what we did, or at least it's going to be the measure of whether we did the right things. Anti-government forces. I think it's always dangerous to aggregate. That is a term that's used often in Afghanistan to aggregate what we mean. But I think it is important at the very minimum to disaggregate between what you might, for want of a better term, classic terrorists and the Taliban movement. The reason I demarcate them this way is that we believe there are elements in Afghanistan who are going to target humanitarians because they're innocent, not because they're culpable. Because that, at its core, is the fundamental nature of terrorism. ICRC got targeted. The first international casualty when we were there was, and actually, Alex probably remembers the dates better than me, but I think during both the Taliban regime and the immediate post-Taliban regime, the first international casualty was an ICRC international staffer. The largest mass killing of internationals was MSF. At some level, we all know the tragedy in Iraq. At some level, it makes sense that terrorists would target precisely those who least evidently have chosen sides, because that struck more fear into the humanitarians than targeting anyone else. There was no other way to explain it than simply the inculcation of terror. For the Taliban, who are a different entity, why do I believe that somehow all of our activities will not be understood by the Taliban as a political posture that no longer that endangers CARE? CARE still works in Paktia, in Paktika, in Ghazni, in Khost today. We have thousands of staff. Well, thousands is an exaggeration. We have in excess of 1,000 staff. I think 10 of them are internationals, maybe 12. These are Afghan staff. They're out there working in areas which de facto the Taliban, they may not control, but they are a very powerful presence in those provinces. There's no way that you can function effectively in those provinces if the Taliban do not want you to. What dictates our presence there and our ability to continue to perform there and our ability to perform there should the Taliban return to some level of political decision-making in Afghanistan is not, I believe, these positions that we have been taking at the global level, but the perception of those positions by the Taliban. Why was CARE doing that? I believe our staff out there are explaining to the Taliban on a day-to-day basis that our fundamental motivation is the best interests, the human rights of ordinary Afghans. And they are going to treat us in the future and today exactly the same way as they treated us in 1999, with deep suspicion that we were part of a Western cultural and religious agenda, but with some level of tolerance. If local community leaders told them these guys are providing services that we need, if they perceive those needs are very real, and they know the organization. CARE was there before the Taliban, they were there during the Taliban, they're certainly there after the Taliban, and they will be there whatever the political configuration Afghanistan experiences, as long as we are continually able to convey through our Afghan staff that our first and foremost commitment is to the human rights and needs of the people in those areas. International military actors, how did they perceive what we were doing? It was interesting in our discussions over the, in Virginia. We had a representative from the U.S. Army Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Unit. We had somebody from the DOD, and both of them shared the argument that the larger goals, and there is, in their view, a commonality of goals, which are to do with the best interests of the people in these environments. The U.S. military is not capable, nor does it desire, to offer all of the services necessary required to create safe space for humanitarian action. They need other actors. And it's the nature of the relationships with the other actors that we have to work out. There were some very interesting discussions about whether there was any we that could be talked about constructively in those discussions. And I think, I maybe I'm presuming a little too much, but I think there was a sense that perhaps it was important to understand the different agendas and reasons for being in context, but there were certain areas where a commonality of interests could be identified, and it's how you negotiated those interests and how you portrayed them to the people around you that was perhaps most important. One reflection I shared at the meeting was a discussion we had between the NGOs and the military. The head of NATO at the time was General Hillier, and he basically argued, he did a very interesting graph, which the NGOs continually turned back to talk about how we engage with the military, where he put on the vertical axis the tolerance of Afghan communities for international forces on their soil, and on the horizontal axis, time. And he basically said, our experience has been in peacekeeping operations pretty much everywhere we've gone, and certainly our experience here, that if you act responsibly as a peacekeeping force, the tolerance of peacekeeping forces in the short term will go up. And it will stay fairly high over a period of time. It may go up and down depending on how you conduct yourself. But after a defined period of time, ultimately local populations will cease to tolerate foreign forces on their soil, regardless of the intention of those forces. And our goal, he said, was to extend the period of time that local populations in Afghanistan would tolerate us being there. And that's why we need, said he, to work so closely with you, why we need to engage in reconstruction activities, why we need to focus on hearts and minds as well as military intervention. That helped us to understand the perspective and what their motivations were, but the arguments of the NGOs looking at that same chart was there is no cutoff date for us. In fact, if things get to the point where you feel you have to leave, that may be precisely the point at which the humanitarian NGOs are being asked to come in to meet basic needs of what is an increasingly failing state. So, okay, our challenge, it said, please go on for another 30 minutes because you're so interesting. So our challenge was to balance these two things. Okay, I have plenty of reflections to share about what it's been like to be in government and experience the whole humanitarian discussion. I will say I had the privilege, just one comment on that, I had the privilege of working for what I thought were some of the most visionary and progressive Afghan leaders in Ashraf Ghani, his successor Anwar Ahadi, and I now work for the economic advisor to President Karzai, Ishak Nadiri. These are progressive, internationally oriented individuals. I think it's fair to say that humanitarian space and the status of NGOs was not only not a massive concern for them, it was not an issue that they thought, well, I mean, that's basically the way to say it. It simply wasn't a massive concern for them. And if we are going to, I think it's indispensable if we are going to succeed in expanding humanitarian space in these kinds of environments, we nurture the knowledge, relationships, and interests of sovereign leaders. And I think we've done a very bad job of it in the NGO community, the United Nations, and the international community more generally. It's just not on the agenda anymore. In a way that it used to be in 2004, it's not there anymore. The protection of NGOs has been a whipping boy for just about everybody in the Afghan context. Lastly, I can't stop without saying what I think my own perspectives are of whether we've succeeded in the eyes of the Afghan people. I'm not sure whether we've succeeded in the eyes of the Afghan people, but I am fairly confident that they view much of this debate about humanitarian space as missing the point, which is the service of their interests. I think many of the arguments about humanitarian space are simply too nuanced for them to think will meaningfully affect their well-being. When they look at debates between classic humanitarians and NGOs like CARE that have gotten more political in Afghanistan, they really want to know what this meant for them. And I think ultimately that's how they will measure decisions and inform their policymakers about how decisions should be made in the ultimate point where Afghans are asked to endorse or expel humanitarians. I would like to think that the advocacy we did was always oriented by their best interests. And so if I had to do it all again and be part of something in the same way, I think we would have done more, not less, of politicized humanitarianism.
Well, thank you very much. This does raise some great controversial questions I'm sure we'll come back to. Let me now turn the table to Randy.
Thank you very much. It's been a really, really interesting discussion, a couple of days, as you can imagine, just hearing Bruce and Paul summarize some of the things that they were talking about in their sessions. The group that I was in was to talk about different approaches to creating security and to address three very broad questions. One regarding the role of the military in protection, which is irony. I was the only NGO in the group, and I'm going to try to feed back to you the role of the military in protection is a little bit challenging. The second question was really, what does protection mean? What does security mean? Are these concepts different from each other? And then the third was, is there a need for a coherence, which I guess would be self-evident, but to the extent to which we need a more coherent conceptualization of protection. So I'm confronted with a personal paradox that I have. If I listen, I don't take good notes. If I take notes, I don't listen very well. You'd think they'd be complementary skills, and it sort of... places great question on everything I've written in my career, but anyway, I will try to sort of summarize some of the things that were put on the table in this discussion, despite the lack of notes. So the first question was, what methods do military actors employ to create security and ensure civilian protection? And what similarities do they have, if any, with civilian approaches? I think from the very sort of theme throughout the whole couple of days was the recognition that there's a difference between coercive and non-coercive protection with, you know, there's sort of broad euphemisms, if you will, for military versus humanitarian protection. There was, I would say, pretty broad recognition of the idea that sometimes the best thing you can do to protect civilians is to kill the bad guys, which is, you know, clearly coercive protection. There was surprisingly little discussion around the DoD directive of a couple of years ago, late 2005, giving the U.S. military more of a mandate in humanitarian work. And the military perspective on the panel seemed to be that in the provide and protect conceptualization, it's the military that protects and the humanitarians that provide, and to sort of perhaps oversimplify it. There was also recognition that the military's role in protection is going to depend a lot on its mandate in a given context. If the military is there as a combatant, as a warfighting institution, it really cannot serve a very effective humanitarian role. I'm not sure that there was a consensus around that idea, but it's certainly my feeling. But even furthermore, I think the paradox for Americans is that as we project our military forces in non-humanitarian ways in environments like Iraq and Afghanistan, it undermines our ability to serve a protection or a humanitarian role in other environments. And I mean, we wouldn't dream now of sending U.S. forces to Darfur in a humanitarian or a peacekeeping role. And it really raises questions to what role we can play in other environments like that as a humanitarian military role. There's also a very, very interesting discussion about whether military forces had the right training to provide protection. For example, the AU and ECOWAS, neither one of them actually have protection protocols that, to anyone's knowledge, in the group. Military actors get very uncomfortable if they don't have an enemy to fight. They get uncomfortable with sort of the uncertainty of the kind of environments that we work in, where it's not really clear who good guys are and bad guys are. And so there was a lot of discussion about whether the police wouldn't be better, a better institution to provide this protection role. And kind of the hybrid that we all kind of agreed on was really the best is this whole concept of a constabulatory. Help me.
Constabulary.
Thank you. The irony or the difficulty being that the military is the institution that has a surge capacity to respond, and the police and other such forces do not. So it becomes a question, do we really need to focus more on giving our military internationally the specialized skills in policing and humanitarian protection? And, you know, finally, there was just a recognition that peace building and peacemaking take a long time, that coercive protection is needed, intelligence secure in a secure environment. The second question that we talked about, how do the various actors involved interpret the term security and protection? It was really one that led me to call the conveners early on and say, well, what do you want me to talk about, security or protection? Because at least from an NGO perspective, these are very different concepts. And, of course, they said, well, talk about both and what's the difference between the two. You know, again, we got back to this distinction between coercive and non-coercive protection. But then we talked a lot more about the concept and the definition of protection that's more common in the humanitarian community, that protection is really about protecting rights. And even though I think within my humanitarian community, within the NGO community, there's some struggling with the difference between providing physical protection for our beneficiaries and protecting their rights to food, to housing, to shelter, to education. So there was some discussion of that. The NGO community here in the U.S., through the represented perhaps by the Interactions Protection Working Group, embraces ICRC's definition of protection. And I'll read that. It's very brief. All activities aimed at obtaining full respect for the rights of individuals in accordance with the letter and spirit of the relevant bodies of law. Those relevant bodies of law, I think, as you all know, are international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, international refugee law, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the covenants that are related to that. So if that's our operating definition of what protection is, arguably there's really not much difference between providing relief and providing protection. It's one and the same thing. And indeed, there's an argument among many humanitarian organizations that that's the case. And in fact, you've seen in the last decade or so here in the States, more and more of the mainstream humanitarian organizations define themselves as rights-based actors, that they base their activities on human rights as defined in these international law. That said, the Protection Working Group at Interaction, as you know, representing 165 American NGOs, put out a brochure a couple of years ago in 2004 called Making Protection a Priority. And it's kind of an interesting document because it opens up endorsing the ICRC definition of protection. But then it goes on to spell out five strategies which suggest that there really is a difference between protecting human rights and protecting the safety and security of our beneficiaries in a conflict situation. And those five strategies, let me just talk very briefly about them. The first one, again, is especially separates the two concepts because it says we really have to integrate protection into the way we provide relief, suggesting, again, that they're two very different concepts. How do we do that? I mean, it's how we design our programs. Look, we can't get into this truck and chuck mode, as we hear about. We can't have cookie-cutter programs that we implement the same way in every context. We have to look at the programs that we're implementing and how they can undermine the safety and security of our beneficiaries. The classic example is where and how you build latrines, where you site them. Do they subject our beneficiaries to sexual assault? But I think there's been more and more proactive programming that provides protection. And I think a classic example that we're hearing of more and more is in Darfur, where a number of refugees have taken on fuel-efficient wood stoves. And, okay, this sounds like an environmental project or something like that, but it's a response to the very high reported rapes and sexual assaults coming from women going out to collect firewood. So the solution was, how do you more efficiently cook so you don't have to go out and collect so much firewood? And they came up with a design made out of mud that requires one-third the firewood that would be normally required in cooking just open the way people do. So it, I haven't seen any very good studies of whether this has actually decreased the incidence of rape, but certainly it's addressing that correlation. It's an example, I think, of a very proactive program approach to integration and protection. The other strategies are just for us to be a lot more focused on data, to be data-driven, to make sure that we're collecting age and gender information about populations we serve, that we understand who the vulnerable groups are and why they're vulnerable and how we can address that vulnerability, that we're serious about monitoring and evaluation, that we're sharing the results of our assessments, which it's a real challenge for NGOs, but getting a little better on it. Capacity building. It's very, very important. We have a high turnover industry, if you will. Most of our staff are not deployed to the field but are hired locally, so we have to spend a lot of time on training and orientation, the concepts of international law, protection, code of conduct, so on and so forth. But we also have to do capacity development with local partners, with other local institutions. Some NGOs are doing protection training with police departments, with military actors on the ground. So this capacity building is a very important part of a protection strategy. Coordination, working together not only as humanitarian actors, but with the UN, with other local organizations, sharing the information that we have, and also working together, not only sharing information from assessments, for example, but actually doing our assessments and our evaluations together helps us to have a common language, common understanding of protection issues in any given context. And the final strategy in the interagency or in the protection working groups document is advocacy. And this is, I think, one of the most challenging ones. In natural disasters, it's pretty easy for us to go public about humanitarian conditions of you know, the survivors of a disaster. In complex emergencies, it becomes much more complex. Again, the Darfur example right now, today as we speak, the humanitarian organizations which are actually operational in Darfur face a huge challenge in talking to the public about what they're seeing and witnessing what they're seeing on the ground, which is so important to affecting the policy changes and the resource needs of addressing that. But we can't do it because it puts our staff at risk. It puts our staff at danger. It puts us at risk of being able to address the program needs that we're addressing in the field. So we find a number of different ways to do that. We have closed-door meetings on the Hill. We go to State Department. We go to National Security Council. We go to the UN. We go to European governments, and we go to donors to describe. We provide background to media. We share confidential reports with human rights organizations, which are not operational and therefore can speak more publicly about humanitarian conditions on the ground. So those are the five strategies of how NGOs and humanitarian actors can operationalize protection on the ground. We also talked a little bit about security, and at least in terms of language, humanitarian NGOs tend to talk about security of aid workers and not so much and talk about protection of civilians. So it's kind of how we separate those concepts. And then finally, the last question that my group addressed was the extent to which protection of civilians requires greater coherence or complementarity among distinct types and levels of international response that currently exist. Did I read that right? Paul, I think, referred to the one comment, said that we should stop using the humanitarian we because there isn't that much coherence in the humanitarian community. There really isn't a humanitarian we. Perhaps overstated, I will still talk about we. But there's clearly significant differences in the way the different actors define protection, define security, and very different roles that we have to play. I think there was a recognition that we all have very different roles, but I think there was also a recognition in the group that we need to make a lot of progress in terms of having a common language and a common conceptualization of what the problems are that we face so that we can interface more effectively on the ground. So I guess I conclude with that. I will say that it was very interesting that there was very little discussion of the UN protection cluster, and I perhaps should have brought that into discussion a little bit more myself, but it seems to me like that's part of the UN reform. It's part of the way that we'll be coordinating around protection, and I think we need to pay a lot more attention to that cluster system if it's to work. So I would challenge all of us to keep that in mind as we move the protection agenda forward. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Randy. I will, in the interest of time, immediately move over to my colleague, Taylor.
Take one and pass it along.
Thank you, Carola. I participated in the final panel discussion of the event, the two-day conference, called Defining and Measuring Success in Human Security. This got at some of the data questions that came up earlier, whether or not there should be common standards. And in fact, we were asked to address three different questions. First is, what approaches already exist to measure civilian protection? Secondly, what are the key challenges of developing and applying benchmark indicators for determining success and or failure? And third, is it in fact desirable or is it counterproductive to have a common standard of performance across all types of actors? There was general agreement with some variation that a basic standard is desirable and is in fact possible, and that standard is civilian mortality. That does not exclude other standards that may be applied within organizations, but people dying and what they're dying from is a minimal standard across organizations that is fairly acceptable. There are, as you've already heard, Randy mentioned that from the NGO perspective, protection means protecting rights, which involves a lot more than simply making sure that people stay alive. Protection can also be seen to address violent conflicts that don't lead to death, notably rape, displacement, and so forth. However, I think people generally agreed in the group that there is, at this early stage, a desire to have a common standard, at least as a baseline, across the different kinds of actors, because there are so many different perspectives on what is going on in these complex emergencies. There needs to be a common language, even if within different sectors, within the NGO world, within the military world, within the government world, if there are a variety of objectives, it's good to have commonality at the same time. There was also a general agreement that there's very little ability currently to actually apply this common standard, simple and minimal though it is. Evaluating the effectiveness of any particular organization or government's actions, or even evaluating the effectiveness of an entire event within a country is something that we're not very good at doing. There's a lot of room and there's a lot of need for improvement. That improvement, I think, can be categorized in three ways, at least according to the discussion that we had. The first is the need for better data and data analysis. The second is a need for an institutionalization of the concept within governments of protecting civilians. And the third category is to develop an overall approach to how to do protection better. So let me talk about each of those in turn, and I'll focus mostly on the last because that was my presentation and I know it best. Better data. Serious epidemiological work began on the effects of violence in about the 1960s. And I mention epidemiology because It is a data-driven science, and its application to war zones is, I think, an impressive way to try to figure out what is going on from a human security perspective. Since the 1960s up to the present, there's been a fairly consistent improvement in data collection, both in terms of the tools used and the practices followed. Nonetheless, and this comes from my colleague Steve Hanch, who is at Georgetown University. He says, and he has been in this business of epidemiological approaches to violence for about as long as anybody else. In his judgment, data collection is at about 40% of optimum. We're getting better and better at getting down to the grassroots and figuring out what mortality rates are and why people are dying, but we're not halfway there. Data analysis, on the other hand, is only at about 20% of what it should be. We're still not very good at figuring out how to use the data that we have. And estimating the impact of an intervention is only at 10%. So there's a lot of work still to be done. Some of the most useful work in this area is at the macro level, and that's in the Human Security Report. Andrew Mack was on our panel. He runs the Human Security Project at University of British Columbia, which came out with the Human Security Report about a year and a half ago, and they're going to do this on an almost annual basis. He has also struggled with data. The data on the number of wars in the world and violent conflicts is pretty reliable. A war or a violent conflict is a big event, and we tend to notice them when they happen. Nonetheless, it's taken a long, long time for us to collate them in a coherent and agreed manner. The data on the number of people being killed by violence, however, is much less reliable for several reasons. One of the most important being that we can only record what has been reported. And until recently, most of that reporting came through news media. And not surprisingly, a lot of reporters don't go to the nastiest places in the world, and so some of the worst violence doesn't get adequately reported. This leads to, in fact, undercounting of the effects of war. The main findings of the Human Security Report, just very briefly, and they're counterintuitive, or not counterintuitive, but they run against the grain of common understanding. The first is that, in fact, since the end of the Cold War, with a brief blip in the middle of the 1990s, the incidence of violence around the world has gone down. That we're seeing less violence of nearly all types than we have seen in the past. The one thing that doesn't fit in there is terrorism. We tend to see more of that. Secondly, he argues in this report, or the report argues, I should say, that this reduction in the amount of violent conflict is due to the actions of the UN, other international and regional organizations, and governments, that it's a matter of agency. It's not just an accident. And that argues that that we've actually started doing a better job, despite the fact that there's a lot of work on figuring out what the impact is. He's really stuck his neck out on this one and said that we can attribute the reduction in violence to certain actors. He's one of the first people to make that argument about the UN, and certainly in this country, it's a surprising one to a lot of people. There's another effort that I want to mention, which is ALNAP, the Active Learning Network for Accountability and Performance. And this is one of the first really sustained efforts to look at impact evaluation. Let me just say quickly, I keep using this term impact evaluation. What is impact evaluation? Well, there's different ways of looking at an activity. Impact is often distinguished from outcome. So, for example, an outcome is, well, yes, a humanitarian organization, to use Randy's term, trucked and chucked a ton of food. Well, that's the outcome. What's the impact of that ton of food? Did it, in fact, save people's lives? Did it go to the types of people who were in need of food? Did it provide the kind of nutrition they needed? And that's an important question because all of these organizations, whether they're governmental or non-governmental, have limited resources and they want to make sure that what they're doing, in fact, leads to the outcome that they want to know, that they want to achieve. So you need to know more than just bean counting, what did you do? You need to know what impact, what effect did it have? All right, the second area of improvement, and I'll just do this one quickly, is institutionalizing the concept and practice of civilian protection. Bruce gave us a good overview of the development of the norm and the concept of the responsibility to protect. This has been a prominent debate in a number of circles. And despite the prominence of this, very few governments, even the ones, it might be safe to say no government, even if it does support this norm, has dealt with the issue of protection in a humanitarian, in a human security sense, has dealt with it in a serious way. There are not governmental agencies that have mandates for civilian protection specifically. It's not built into their budgets. It's not part of their standard operating procedures. At this point, the rhetoric has not translated into an institutionalized capacity for human security. So there's a broad need, a need for a broad effort to support the human security approach within governments. Now, how do we do this? One way to do it is a better understanding of what does and does not work, coming back to the central theme, which leads me to my part of the presentation on looking at how to achieve success. If we define success, and I'm gonna split another hair here, which is an important hair. The first one was the difference between outcome and impact. The second one is the difference between looking at mortality rates and looking at the number of lives saved. And the reason that this is important is, again, to understand what the effects are of outsiders who try to protect civilians in crisis situations. If, for example, you know that mortality dropped in a certain country during a crisis, you want to know why it dropped. You want to go beyond correlation of, well, yes, the international community went in and started feeding people. Well, did that cause the mortality rate to drop, or did the mortality rate drop because it rained and that allowed the agricultural sector to, in fact, feed people? So we're looking not just at how many people died, but we're looking at the counterfactual side of how many people would have died if there were not external action, but didn't die because that action was taken. It's a tough counterfactual judgment, and it leads to all sorts of methodological problems, which I won't bore you with, but I'd be happy to talk about in the discussion if anybody wants to. So the answer of how to achieve success depends, of course, on the context and the types of actions that outsiders are willing to take. And in my work, which I should mention, I should have said this at the beginning, was supported. This handout that I have is drawn from a book that Carola mentioned that I'm about to publish called Humanitarian Military Intervention, The Conditions for Success and Failure. And that book was supported by a USIP grant before I became a USIP employee. So I'm in the odd position of being both a grantee and an employee of the same organization. I got that grant while I was at SIPRI, and when I took a job here, they took back what remained of the grant. Instead of paying me, they took back my money. Didn't quite work that way. Anyway, I appreciate the grant and the ability that it gave me to do the research and writing for this book. In that work, I focused on the extreme case. We've talked about a range of ways of securing civilians, and I looked at the extreme case of military intervention for the stated purpose of helping the indigenous population. This is commonly known as humanitarian intervention, humanitarian military intervention, intervention for human protection purposes, what have you. If you look at one side of the handout, you'll see something called Table 1.8, the success and failure in the 1990s. I looked at six of the major cases of humanitarian intervention following the end of the Cold War. During the 1990s was a formative decade for the modern concept of humanitarian intervention. And I looked within those six cases at 17 different military operations. This allowed me to do both cross-case and within-case comparisons to see what was going on. And very briefly, I contend that military intervention succeeded more often than it failed. Of the 17 different military operations, 9 succeeded in saving lives, 4 failed to save lives, and 2 of those 4 actually made things worse. And 4 interventions had a mixed record, which means that they did save lives, but only in the context of failing to save many more lives, that they didn't do nearly as good a job as they could have. Well, how do we explain this, what I would call a decidedly mixed record of success and failure? To help do that, I developed a typology, which is on the other side of the handout. There's a 2x2 matrix that represents, in schematic form, the possible types of humanitarian intervention, the way I see them. Along the humanitarian dimension, that is the vertical one, outsiders can choose either to address privation or to address violence. And these are not exclusive. They can choose to address both, so you can operate in more than one of the boxes at the same time. Along the political dimension, the horizontal one, outsiders can choose to focus on the victims or focus on the perpetrators. One of the things I like about looking at it this way is that it reflects very much what Paul was talking about, which is the political nature of humanitarian action. I think it's a mistake to believe that you can be non-political in the environment where people are dying. And you're bringing in resources that matter. Humanitarian action is political. You can see that there are 4 basic objectives that you can try to achieve with humanitarian military intervention. One is to deliver assistance directly. And this is something that humanitarian organizations, I'm talking in this chart about what military actors can do. And so it's important to keep in mind that box number 1, assisting aid delivery, is something that aid organizations don't like the military to do most of the time. It infringes on what they see as their mandate, and it crowds out the idea of humanitarian space. There are some circumstances in which even aid organizations see this as a legitimate thing to do. An example is in 1991, after the first Gulf War, when the Kurds were driven up into the mountains bordering Turkey and Iraq. And the military was able to get in with life-saving supplies and dig latrines and so forth before any humanitarian organizations could get there. The second possible objective is to protect aid organizations. This is sometimes necessary, and this is, as you can see from the chart lower down, I parse out further what comes under each of these titles. Protection includes things like escorting convoys, guarding buildings, safe areas, and so forth. This also is sometimes necessary and also endangers the idea of humanitarian space because it inherently puts aid organizations in a position of at least looking like and often being dependent upon the military for their safety. This is uncommon, but certainly has happened. Fourth, you can try to protect military organizations can try to protect the population, and 5th, they can try to defeat the perpetrators. Defeating perpetrators isn't really a humanitarian action, but as you heard earlier, there is a general agreement among a lot of people, at least, certainly not universal, that one of the best ways to protect people in war situations is, in fact, to stop the war. As a general rule, success in these 4 types is more difficult as we move from box 1 to box 4, but interestingly, the historical record, historical in the sense of 10 years, shows that success has been most common for the easiest and hardest types, that is, assisting aid delivery, box 1, and defeating the perpetrator in box 4. I surmise that the reason for this is that countries who seek to protect aid operations or seek to protect civilians don't really know how hard it is to do. And they go in unprepared for the rigors of their objectives. I won't go into the second table on the page. It further develops the typology, and I'll leave that level of detail aside. Since I focused, let me say that I think the key to successful humanitarian intervention in terms of saving lives is strategy. I got a note saying 30 more minutes too. Strategy is, in its simplest form, selecting goals and choosing the appropriate means to achieve them. Without a coherent strategy, intervention is very likely to fail. This seems like a pretty straightforward idea, but it's one that doesn't seem to have sunk in. Now, there's a question of whether you can have when you, a coherent strategy when the decisions and actions taken in these complex emergencies are not taken by a coherent body. It's not a single government that tries to do this. It's a collection of governments. It's a regional organization. It's the UN. To what extent can you even hope to have a coherent strategy? My argument isn't that this is what you should expect, but it's what you should strive for. Without even trying to have a strategy, without trying to understand exactly what your objectives are, what you need to do to achieve them, and what the resources required are, that there's very little chance that you're going to succeed no matter what it is you try to do. I'd be happy to talk more about that, but let me just skip to the end and make a couple of points. A lot of people think that humanitarian intervention depends on, and I'll use some of the language of just war theory here, right intention and right authority. That if you're going to go in to save people's lives, you have to do it out of the goodness of your heart, that you can't do it for selfish political reasons. And that you need to be authorized by the UN or another legitimate regional body. I don't disagree with the second one, but I think the first one leads to some misguided thought. And in fact, past experiences have shown that when military forces get involved in these situations, they're in fact more likely to succeed at saving lives when they do have some political incentives, in addition to humanitarian ones. There has to be a mix. And the reason for this is that these are very nasty situations. We're talking in most instances about war, and wars are not places where philanthropy is enough motivation to stick it out when the going gets tough and to devote the kinds of resources and take the kinds of risks that are necessary. Again, coming back to the idea that these are political situations. Let me just close by relating this somewhat abstract discussion back to the real world. I think a look at strategy, particularly in this schematic framework, explains the failure to take effective action in Darfur. The situation there requires operating in boxes 3 or 4, that is, either trying to protect civilians or defeat the perpetrators. And these are very tough things to do. Even though many governments and the UN Security Council have condemned the violence in Darfur in strong terms, they all recognize that they're not willing to take the risks required or devote the political and material resources required to actually make forceful intervention their work. Nonetheless, we continue to hear calls by a lot of people for strong consideration, and in fact, sometimes actually going beyond consideration and already acting, to forcefully intervene because the government of Sudan is not doing what it needs to do, and neither are the rebels, to end the violence there and solve the conflict. In fact, just last Sunday in the Washington Post, there was an op-ed by a couple members of Congress, senators, who said that military intervention should be a serious option. I think that if governments are not willing to take those risks and commit those resources, that going in forcefully would in fact make things worse in Darfur and not better. And I'll stop with that.
Taylor, thank you very much. I will reserve my chair's prerogative until the end because I'd really like to hear some of the comments. If you could please introduce yourself and keep your questions and comments as short as possible. We'll cluster them, if you don't mind, panelists. Take a few at a time and then ask you to respond. Milton, please introduce yourself.
Point that's something in Taylor's presentation. I drastically disagree with Andy Mack's conclusions, and I've been gathering data on these things for 35, 40 years. The last generation just published this summer. The underreporting is not because there's poor reporting by journalists or NGOs. The numbers in his compendium of patently ridiculous for social science criteria, for deliberately selected criteria by the compiler. That is, he accepts the correlates of more criteria, the counts. Just one of the three criteria being that you have to have 1,000 battlefield deaths. You take the 800,000 of the men killed in Rwanda, it's not a half of the 1%. That were battlefield deaths. If take what happened in Cambodia with Khmer Rouge, it's 0% that were battlefield deaths. And if you decide to leave those out, you get just idiot calculations at the end.
You're taking several?
Yeah, we'll take several. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Larry Rader. I'm the UN Director for the World Society for the Protection of Animals. Until last October, I was the head of disaster management at the IO Bureau of the State Department. And I wanted to think about protection from the optic of livelihood protection, which I don't hear enough about. We think of protection oftentimes as, you know, putting a campground, being more protected. That's really not the most important thing. It is important. But if we don't think about what happens after the crisis, where does it happen in a crisis? I think it's just a short story because Paul was talking about Afghanistan. We have a station in Jalalabad, and this old guy came to our station with his old horse, and it was falling apart. And, you know, in the United States, the horse would have been put down because of its sores, because it was worried with the hoof, and so forth. That was the entire source of income for this man and his family. And without it, he could not have fed his family, he could not have purchased clothing, and so forth. And there were thousands of people like that throughout Jalalabad who used horses to haul cargo and do other things. And so we reduced the mortality rate by about 80% for equines. What that meant was that these people now had a hope of, in the post-conflict era, of actually doing something with their lives. Now, if we hadn't done that, this is like a microcosm, right? If we hadn't done this, where would that guy have gone? In many parts of the world, he's going to go to people like the Taliban or the Hezbollah or Hamas, because they offer some economic hope oftentimes. It is a way to reduce conflict. So I just wanted to argue that when we talk about protection of these folks, we give some real thought to not simply the police action, the security action, but also think about what does it take for this person to keep maintain his living after the crisis. We see in Darfur people losing their animals to rebels. We see in Pakistan after an earthquake people not going to camps because their livestock's not protected. Knowing in the spring they're not protected, they got nothing. And they're going to go right into the cities, which are overcrowded. So it's not a fresh idea, but I don't think it's given enough emphasis. So I just want to throw that out as a concept.
Yes, please.
My name is Mr. Tidibe. I'm a greetings colleague from the second class. My question is, what kind of solution would you provide for military and action operation in Congo, for example, where most of the time when the UN operation soldiers camp, most of the time they people are already killed. What solution would you provide to save the victims?
All right. Judy.
Judy Russell, USIP, and I was actually at the conference, and I have to say that I benefited even more today by sitting and listening to what I think is some really brilliant information from the discussion, which helped put some of it in perspective. I have a question. At the conference, there was some limited kind of debate and exchange between the civilian and military participants about some of the difficulties that result from that interaction, which didn't get a lot of comments, I think, at the conference, but certainly was a kind of foundation for a discussion. And USIP itself has been engaged in an ongoing effort to provide a space in which civilian and military participants in humanitarian interventions can continue to talk with each other about whose space is it, and who has responsibility for what, and how does the behavior of one actor affect the behavior of the other actor in collective terms. My question for Paul is whether, given this kind of debate that has you so starkly and nicely portrayed within the NGO community, humanitarian aid organization community, can you tell us a little bit more about how that debate is progressing within that community? Are there efforts internally within that community to to kind of tease out the different perspectives and try to resolve some of them. If you could just be a little bit more explicit about that.
Thank you. Why don't we go to the panel and then we'll take another round. Taylor, would you like to start us off?
Sure. Yes, Milton, the data is terrible. I think that's widely recognized. And I hope I reflected accurately the tenor of the discussion that there's a huge need for better data and better data analysis. Nonetheless, we operate with what we have. A lot of the work of Andy Mack and his colleagues is based on the correlative work criteria, and there is the problem that you mentioned that it doesn't even count, doesn't even show up in the data unless 1,000 people have been killed on the battlefield, which means that you're not counting all the civilians who die from their livestock being killed, and then they subsequently don't have a way to live and through displacement and so forth. I will say that he has the Human Security Project has commissioned other database studies that are trying to overcome this problem, but it takes a long time to collect that kind of data. So absolutely, there's need for improvement. But it's better to work with what you have than to not even try. Also, I would say that there is better data on particular events, that it's hard to collect really good data across a series of events, but some events have actually been studied very well. You're probably all familiar, for example, with the IRC study on the Democratic Republic of the Congo that has been done in at least two iterations that does look not just at battle deaths, but at civilian deaths overall from the war, and estimates in excess of 3 million people killed in that war, which is extraordinary. My own work depended heavily on reports in medical journals by epidemiologists who went out into the field, went into the refugee camps, went into the IDP camps and so forth, and tried to figure out what people were dying from and what the mortality rates were. And so that data is pretty good, but you don't get it globally. Let me address the what solution for late action. You're absolutely right that timing is very important. The sooner we react, for the most part, and it's not a universal rule, but it's a rule of thumb, the quicker you react, the more lives you can potentially save. This gets back to the question raised earlier by Bruce about capacity, capacity and political will. There is no quick answer, but I think there is movement toward recognizing that this is a problem and building capacity not just to respond with different kinds of forces, police forces and so forth, but to get on the ground quickly. There are always going to be problems, particularly if we want to keep doing these things with broad legitimacy, which means through the UN. The UN doesn't act quickly most of the time. It can do in certain circumstances, but timing is going to remain a real issue.
Randy?
The livelihood question?
Yes.
It wasn't a question as much as a comment, it seemed, and I absolutely concur. I think there has to be an appreciation, though, for the challenge of dealing with livelihoods, in particularly in chronic emergencies or chronic crises. In natural disasters, I think my organization and many others go in very early on and look at the economics and livelihoods. They go in with cash reward programs and look for, you know, small grants to businessmen and micro lending and all this kind of stuff, and try to get local economies going as quickly as possible. And I've seen more and more recognition of that, the importance of that. Even my organization has emergency people, economics people on emergency teams. So, but in chronic emergencies, it is a huge, huge challenge. I mean, you look at situations in, you know, southern Sudan and Afghanistan and places where you have millions of people displaced into camps for a generation or more who completely lose their livelihoods. I mean, they've never seen the way their parents raised money when they were, you know, they'd never been exposed to that. And it becomes a huge, huge challenge to get livelihoods going again. And then also in this chronic emergencies, there's how do you work with livelihoods in a camp setting? I mean, you have settings where, you know, Thailand was classic. Refugees cannot earn money. It's against the law. well, first of all, they didn't call them refugees there. So, and then even where they can earn money, there's real concern. I mean, Kakuma in Kenya, a refugee camp of who knows how many, 65, 80,000 people, there's nothing to earn money doing. I mean, there's some people are very creative, and you find livelihoods within the camps, but it's not an economically sustainable community by any stretch of the imagination. And things that people do to raise money in that camp setting are not the kinds of things that they would necessarily be able to take home with them. So there's huge, huge challenges to it, and huge challenges to finding resources to working with livelihoods, particularly in those protracted emergencies. But, yeah, point very well taken. I absolutely agree with you.
Did you want to add anything on the question of the humanitarian debate?
And humanitarian space? I wouldn't even know where to start with that. It's just...
whole nother seminar.
It's a huge, huge issue that we're really, really concerned about. And just the need, particularly in situations like Iraq and Afghanistan, where the United States is a combatant and is also wanting to lay claim to part of the humanitarian space, that really clouds the meaning of humanitarianism, endangers our staff, causes, I think, really huge problems. And I also don't think it's, for a whole host of reasons, is not an appropriate role, just from a practical point of view, of military actors in that kind of context. But we could talk forever about it.
Paul, would you like to respond or more?
Sure. Over in the office I now work in, we seconded both military folks and NGO folks working on national development planning, and the cultural differences between the two when they came in, fairly obvious. There was lots of, you know, oh, there go the tree huggers, there go the ticknecks, you know. These are not two sets of cultures that interact naturally with each other in many environments politically, and in fact, in terms of physical space, it didn't happen all the time. So it's a real question. Very powerful force and one, I think, generally agreed to be essential force, engage with each other when they come from two different sets of experiences? I think it's true to say that in 2002, when the whole thing started, the NGOs had to go through a very difficult shift. In the days that Alex was there, pre-Taliban, during the Taliban, the NGOs really ran the state-building show in Afghanistan in many respects. I mean, maybe an overstatement, but together with the UN, there was a complete policy-making vacuum, and the NGOs fairly stepped into that, and they were involved in discussions at the highest levels that once the whole state-building agenda and other military actors came in and said, we need state building to be part of what we do. And the NGO said, hold on a second, we're the people who do economic reconstruction, you kill people, let's keep it that way. And they had real difficulty digesting the fact that actually state building and securing environments for local populations meant a lot more than simply security-oriented stuff. I think perhaps the most concrete manifestation of this was the PRT debate. And I actually think it's a story that can be told that shows of increasing sophistication in how the two sets of actors engaged with each other. The military were saying, we've got to have a presence out there in the field that thinks about reconstruction, provincial reconstruction teams, for those of you who don't know the PRT concept. NGOs initially said, we think a priori, this is a very bad idea, we don't think you should be using the word reconstruction. I think the education process was difficult, but they came to realize that A, we're never going to win this debate, and B, it may actually be an essential part of securing an environment that you can think about reconstruction, governance issues. And then that was a learning curve. I think there were ways over time that we influenced each other in many respects. Now, Alyssa, who represented the Canadian PRT negotiations at the time, said that the NGOs profoundly influenced the way that the Canadian PRT did business. They decided, we're not going to do short-term reconstruction projects, we're going to focus on extending the influence of the Afghan government through security-oriented projects. So it can happen. I will say, though, that all of this is done against a background of profound suspicion by local populations. When CARE took a lot of money from the U.S. government and did projects that were part of the, as I said earlier on, Karzai-led state-building agenda, local populations, I think, do have to be convinced that we are not part of a larger military agenda in Afghanistan. And it is incumbent on organizations like CARE, who claim to be rights-based, to demonstrate that their fundamental motivation is not simply the furtherance of the political goals of their donors, but yes, to the extent they share common goals, they will further common objectives, increasing economic development for ordinary populations. But the only way to really prove your principles is to act in principled ways when they are challenged. And so what CARE had to do, and I want to take back a comment I made a little too quickly to Bruce yesterday. I think there were solid examples where we publicly, through TV, radio, and the press, and I think responsibly, encouraged military action to change its behavior if they were to live up to their best aspirations. And I think it was incumbent, we should have done it more, but we didn't run away from it. I could list a bunch of examples how we challenged the military, basically not to really lose the long-term hearts, particularly of the southern populations, by how they conducted the war there. I think I think the military will understand why you're doing it, and there are ways in which both sets of actors can do what their missions are and find positive attributes in working together.
My question really is related to the internal debate within the NGO community about the price. If you of CARE's stance on this issue and the outcomes that we understand them up to this point, where is the internal debate from the NGO community about the proper position of the humanitarian work take on these issues?
Okay.
Is it on one extreme, the MSF,
I think, to be fair, it's herding cats with the NGOs. In one line answer, I think there are three constituencies. One group has said this is where the money is going to be in the future. This is where our relevance is going to be in the future. If we want to help people, we've got to become part of the program. And they're embedded now. There are NGOs that literally see this as a major source of their funding. The SERP funds through the PRTs, for example. There's another group at the other end of the spectrum, like MSF, that says we are going to survive willy-nilly without touching this. We will not go to a meeting where military people are present. And then there's a group in the middle that says, we have got to find a way to share common ground. And I would say the majority of major American NGOs, the Wilsonian NGOs, occupy that middle ground. They want to find constructive ways to work effectively with military actors, but they're very careful to make sure that does not mean they've seen to be co-opted.
Randy?
Yeah, I think also you have to integrate into the answer to that question what the timeline is and where, if there, in fact, there is a continuum from crises to development, there's a different kind of actor comes in place. And development organizations go into a situation like Afghanistan right now where they're trying to build a state and an economy, and they have to work with the government. I mean, it's very important that they have a very different, you know, approach to that kind of a environment than a humanitarian organization that wants to keep, you know, its neutrality, its impartiality, its distance from the political actors. Development organizations can't succeed unless and until they engage with those very actors. So I think that's what the difficulty with the Sudans and the Afghanistans, where there's been a peace agreement and you're trying to, or a settlement of some kind, and you're trying to move towards development at some point, that humanitarian mode of thinking has to give way to a developmental mode, which really is investing in the political powers that be.
Yeah. Bruce, would you like to...
Just very quickly on the Congo issue. I mean, on the capacity question, I think it's critical here, and there are three dimensions. One is a rapid reaction capacity, which is almost non-existent in international security forces. Second, even if you were to have rapid reaction capacity, it has to get from someplace to someplace, which requires airlift capacity, which is almost non-existent in the international system outside of the U.S. When the United Nations went into Congo in the 1950s, they got there in 48 hours, and they got there because the U.S. provided airlift for free. That doesn't happen anymore. The third point to make about it, I mean, this isn't the rapid reaction point, but I think it just illustrates, the scale of the problem. Steve Stedman did an analysis at one point to say, like, all right, let's assume you want to have a degree of even-handedness in response to these kind of situations, and we'll take the metric of troops per square kilometer or troops per population and compare Kosovo and the Congo. And the short answer is that if you wanted to have the kind of troop density that you have in the Congo to do serious protection of civilians, et cetera, you would need 600,000 troops to do the Congo. I mean, 600,000, short of a kind of existential crisis for the United States or for China, there just aren't 600,000 troops. So, I mean, you're never going to have that scale of response. And so the ways in which the response has been done, targeted responses in Bunia with the EU, a spread of observers and peacekeeping, I have to say, probably, in real terms, is a credible response to the situation, given the real-world constraints that we face.
Alex.
Could you introduce yourself?
Sorry, I'm Alex here from the European Institute. And really following up directly on what Bruce just said, I had wanted to ask with this evolution of the responsibility to protect, whether there are considerations of norms of selectivity. Because it's obvious, and you know, the case of Darfur obviously comes up, Congo comes up, it's obvious that you're not going to be able to do everything that would fall within the broader norms of what has been defined under responsibility today. And so if we know in advance that we're not going to be able to accomplish those objectives, I guess the obvious question is, how do you develop norms of selectivity to determine which ones are going to be taken on? And what is the impact of the failure to take on what seemed to be, in the minds broadly of the international community, clear responsibility? So we've been talking about Darfur for a couple of years now. Everybody wrings their hands. It's about to descend back into hell. Is this an example of something that shouldn't have been done or should have been done? And if it should have been done, you know, what's the failure of this sort of...
Jill, did you have a question earlier that
no.
we overlooked? Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Any other? Yes, please, in the back.
Charles von Boston, Association of the U.S. Army. The Pentagon recently has decided that stability operations is now a central focus for the military, but there has yet to be a force structure change to address that, and in essence, it's going to be a new duty that current members of the military, particularly the Army and Marine Corps, will take on. I'd like to get the panel's reflections on how useful, like what changes the military would need to take to reverse a lot of the errors that have happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how useful that new focus on stability operations is in the context of current warfighting.
All right. Bruce, do you want to start us off?
Yeah. To Alex's question, there are sort of, as far as I can see, without having a chance to think further about it, three criteria potentially come to mind, and there's been very little debate about it. There's no active debate about it in the broad discussion, or let me nuance that. There's no real debate about in the active discussion around these questions. The responsibility to protect doctrine itself, and then the high-level panel endorsement of it gave a series of criteria for debate. Now, the idea of the criteria for debate is not to say it's going to lead to automaticity or, you know, exactly which cases you should and you shouldn't. The idea was to say, given that this issue is so heavily politicized, let's agree on a set of criteria, and they're basically just war criteria. Let's agree on a set of criteria that the Security Council would have to debate before authorizing an intervention to at least demonstrate consideration of a range of factors before authorizing or not authorizing a force. Highly unlikely we're going to see that, and certainly in the negotiations, I'll tell you off the record, when the U.S. government saw the high-level panel report, the one thing that they redlined was criteria. And basically said, if you put criteria on the table, we just walk away totally. And the British didn't have to tell us that because Americans already had, but they would have had they not. In real terms, you could have a power criteria. We're not really talking a whole lot about the R2P mission we're launching for Chechnya. If you talk to Arabs, they will ask us why we're not involved in an R2P operation in Palestine. I mean, you know, okay, but you have to deal with 600,000 Israeli soldiers, you have to deal with the Russian army. So there's a kind of can you get it done criteria, there's a power criteria. The problem, of course, is that both of those criteria, which are credible real-world criteria, absolutely reinforce the suspicions in the Arab and the African world that this is going to be simply undertaken when there are Western interests at stake and not when there are not. I think the only credible thing that you can say here is to fall back on the Security Council and to say, look, we have a system of international law. Forces authorized when the Council authorizes, other than self-defense. If you can get the debate in the Council, if you can get Council authorization, that's when you do it. Okay, there are power realities and there are practical realities, but it's the Council that's the authorizing thing. But it does bring us back to this question I raised about reform of the Council, because most countries in the developing world do not believe that the council adequately reflects anything like a distribution of voice or power or anything like it that reflects the modern world. And so there's a deep suspicion of the council. So I think we're kind of stuck there. But the only one that I can see as being credible is the council route. And sorry, on the stability operations, I think it's critically important. I mean, the sort of elephant in the room here is that this whole business that we're talking about, and goes to your question, Judy, as well, is being transformed by U.S. experience in Iraq and, to a lesser extent, I would say, Afghanistan. We have to bear in mind that international systems are simultaneously being transformed in very different ways by international reactions to the U.S. experience in Iraq and, to a lesser extent, Afghanistan and to the global war on terrorism. Nevertheless, it has long been the case that the fact that the United States was by and large unwilling to get engaged in RTP operations, get engaged in peacekeeping operations in a serious way, was a serious obstacle to actually being able to get the job done. Where U.S. and international interests are more aligned and you can draw on both kinds of capacities, you have a substantially higher ability to get it done. I do think there is going to be a growing challenge for this whole discussion about the fact that peace support operations are increasingly deployed alongside what's either going to be called counterinsurgency or something else operations, now in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Lebanon. How that those two things interplay with one another, or complicate each other's lives, what that means, I think will have a huge impact in the whole responsibility to protect and protecting civilians debate in ways that are as yet a little unclear. But I think it's a critically important development. And I think largely a positive one in terms of the U.S. side of this.
We are running out of time, so a very quick do. Any of the other panelists have burning issues?
Not burning, but it is quick. It's just a quick addendum to that. There was an interesting comment during the meeting by one of the military representatives there from the peacekeeping stability operations, a useful differentiation between education and training. Education, how to think, training, how to do, and both were essential. I would have added recruitment to that as well. I'm sure they do. I think this is you're seeing it in the special forces. If you're going to talk about stabilization, you need a different type, perhaps, of skill sets.
Let me just, in conclusion, just make two very quick comments. One is this session, as well as the conference that we've had, in some ways represents both ongoing past work of the grant program of USIP, as well as what we hope will be a continuing discussion. As you can see from just these presentations, we've only scratched the surface of what are very difficult and continuously evolving problems. USIP at this point has spent about $1.4 million on related questions, probably more if we define protection and humanitarianism in even broader terms. We expect to do much more on this. But I think some of the key issues that have come out of the most recent round of discussions and thinking and work of many of our grantees has been that we are both optimistic and pessimistic about the prospects of humanitarian intervention and R2P. We were accused yesterday of perhaps being a little overly pessimistic because we kept zeroing in on the problems and the fact that there are so many places where we aren't working. But we can't forget that we are, in fact, saving more lives than we would have had we not done anything, that the UN has been tremendously instrumental in keeping this on the table, keeping these issues on the agenda, that we have been able to have conversations today that would have been unthinkable even just 5 years ago, 10 years ago, about questioning what is the responsibility of governments, what is the role of the military. These are all issues that were highly sensitive, and so we should recognize that we are, in fact, moving forward, albeit quite perhaps at a snail's pace for some. Just two other concerns, I think, on the question of norms of selectivity. One way in which we also need to think about this is to make very clear what we cannot do, and to make very clear to people, rather than giving these mixed messages which raise expectations, that there are simply crises where we cannot intervene and where we will not intervene. And in this case, I do use the humanitarian we, as broken as it is, that even if the U.S. decides not to intervene, it's doubtful that you will get Europeans or Africans or Asians who are able to mount the capacity or the political will to really do something. And I think we are beginning to recognize that we learn not just from the failures of humanitarian intervention, but that as we focus on much more micro-level case-by-case studies of what does work, that we take away a more realistic set of expectations. And that certainly is contributing to developing a kind of norm of selectivity, I think. Secondly, just on Milton's point about data, I'd also like to point to the University of Maryland Center for International Development Conflict Management Peace and Conflict Reports, which come out every 2 years. And they actually, before Andrew Mack, have pointed to the importance of the UN, and that data also does extend beyond the battle deaths data, and they do take into account prospects of state failure and so forth. So there are a number of options out there. Finally, let me thank all of you, and I hope that we can continue this conversation over the future, and welcome you to join us for the next several events coming up. Thank you.